much closer now and brighter than when we were young. Venus and Mars and Mercury and Saturn at sunset hung like a diamond on black velvet just to the left of the moon. We watch the sun sets for transcending in me. Maybe a kind of beginning at the end of a long ordeal. We believe in a higher intention somewhere in the darkness beyond. There's a sign of affirmation that we all share a common. We're dancing like the lights far below in town. A feeling swept across us. There were changes all around. Something good's gonna happen. Something transcendent in me.
That was Common Bond by the Kennedys. And now for Peace Talks on Free Radio Santa Cruz about the Gaza Strip pullout. This is an interview with Deborah Gerner, professor of political science and author of One Land, Two Peoples.
Right now, I'm joined on the phone by Deborah Gerner. She is a professor of political science at the University of Kansas. She's also co-director of the Center for International Political Analysis and a member of the editorial committee of the Middle East Report. She is editor of Understanding the Contemporary Middle East and author of One Land, Two Peoples, The Conflict Over Palestine. Hello, Deborah. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Glad to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining me today. We don't have a whole lot of time, so we'll just jump right in. There's been a lot in the news, quite a bit in the news over recent weeks and months about this Gaza disengagement. And I'm wondering what your perspective on the use of the term disengagement is when speaking about Gaza. That's the general term that's been used to describe the pullout.
I think the whole idea of calling what's occurring disengagement is very misleading, actually, because what really is happening is that a limited number of Israeli settlements are being removed, and the settlers are being forced to vacate their homes. But the Israeli military is retaining the right to go back into Gaza at any point that it so chooses. So what we really are seeing is a redeployment of troops, not a permanent withdrawal. So disengagement, I think, is quite misleading. The other thing is that because Israel is going to still maintain control of access in and out of Gaza, it doesn't really free the Gazan Palestinians to move easily from place to place. It's just that their prison has gotten a bit larger than it once was.
And when you say, when you describe Gaza as a prison, can you justify that definition, that description?
Sure. Gaza is a fairly small area, and it's bordered by the Mediterranean and by Israel and by the Sinai. And because Israel controls access in and out of the area, people who live in Gaza really are not free to travel outside of Gaza without the permission of the Israeli government. So that's why I call it a big prison. To be sure, it's going to be easier and better for Palestinians not to be confronting Israeli troops on a daily basis, but they don't have freedom of movement to travel internationally. They don't have freedom of movement to work in other places. So that's why it's really still a big prison.
Not even in Egypt?
No, not even in Egypt. There still is going to be control over that access as well.
You said recently that the actions of the pullout in Gaza, that you feel that's effectively distracting world attention from the continuing construction of the separation barrier in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, as well as a range of other Israeli policies detrimental to all Palestinians. Can you go into that in a little more detail?
Sure, and I think that's something that Mr. Lotterby will be talking about also. But while the rest of the world is paying attention to the Gaza, quote, disengagement, what we see happening is that the separation barrier is continuing to be built at a very rapid pace. And in particular, and most frighteningly from the point of view of Palestinians, it seems that East Jerusalem, which is really critical to any two-state solution of the ongoing conflict, is being cut off by the separation barrier from the rest of the West Bank. At the same time that that's occurring, there are increases in Palestinian home demolitions, and there is an expansion of Israeli settlement activity within what Israel refers to as Greater Jerusalem, which is actually an expansion of Jerusalem into what was previously known of as the West Bank. So what we're getting is a kind of consolidation of control over Jerusalem and a consolidation of control over the settlements in the West Bank, a confiscation of Palestinian land. Probably another 10 to 15% of the West Bank is being confiscated by this separation barrier. And nobody is really paying any attention to that.
So is your argument essentially that the Israeli government is using this Gaza pullout as cover for solidifying their hold and continued appropriation of land in the West Bank and their continued construction of the wall?
That's certainly a big part of my argument, yes. In addition, though, I have to say that the majority of Israelis are not nearly as committed to maintaining control of Gaza as they are committed to maintaining parts of the West Bank. It doesn't have the same kind of religious significance to religious Jews. It is not a popular place for Israeli soldiers to serve. The number of settlers there is quite small, somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000 settlers, compared to between 1.2 and 1.4 million Palestinians. And so getting rid of Gaza is a good thing from Israel's point of view, even apart from its secondary function as a very convenient smoke screen so that we don't notice what's going on in Jerusalem and in the West Bank.
And the reason is that you're arguing that Gaza is actually sapping the Israeli government, maintaining those settlements in there with only, you know, less than 10,000 settlers, is actually sapping them, you know, militarily, financially, and they're deciding well, Sharon at least is deciding it's not worth that. It's a military strategic decision. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that that's certainly a big part of it for Sharon. Not that the other is not also relevant. And in fact, I think the smokescreen argument is the stronger of the two arguments. But it's very, very clear that for, and it's been clear for at least a decade and probably longer than that, that most Israelis would just as soon get rid of Gaza. It's a pain in the butt for them. There's no reason for them to hold on to it, and it's a huge drain on Israeli resources.
You also said that this is kind of a one-sided, that although it appears to be a positive development for both Israelis and Palestinians, its benefits are actually quite one-sided. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Well, part of it is what I just said, which is that the Palestinians are going to get rid of day-to-day Israeli presence, but that's really all they're going to get, whereas Israel is going to save huge amounts of money. It's going to be able to no longer have soldiers in a very dangerous situation, that is, being in Gaza. They can go ahead and take the actions that they're taking in the West Bank, but say to the international community, look what we did in Gaza. We've already withdrawn. This shows good faith on our part. So they're winning lots of political points in the international community for what they're doing at really very little cost to them. So that's why I see it as a one-sided deal. I also think, though, that it's important to say that the settlers who are in Gaza, some of them are there for religious reasons, but a lot of them are there for economic reasons. They went to Gaza because the Israeli government encouraged them to do so. It gave them huge economic benefits. It gave them all sorts of rhetorical reasons why they should go to Gaza. And so there's a certain sense in which the government has manipulated them now twice. First by saying they should go to Gaza, and then when they did so, now saying, no, no, we've changed our mind, now you should leave Gaza. And from my perspective, of course, they should leave Gaza because their presence there is a violation of international law. But it's important, I think, to recognize that the settlers who are there, some of them really did choose to be there for religious or nationalist reasons, but others were there to take advantage of the benefits that the Israeli government provided to settlers. And so they're really being used as pawns in a political game.
Interesting. I've noticed that in the media, there's been a huge amount of focus on this Gaza, quote-unquote, disengagement. And a lot of it's been focused on, oh, look at these poor settlers being uprooted. There's been references to the settlements. The adjective that's often used to describe them is disputed. Not illegal, which is what they are under international law. What do you make of things like the use of, in the media, of terms like disputed Jewish settlements on occupied land, like using that adjective to describe those settlements?
Clearly, there's a great deal of pressure that's being put on the media, not only in the United States, but in other countries as well, although I think it's more pronounced in the United States, to change the rhetoric about how we discuss Israeli occupation. And this use of the term disputed rather than occupied is simply the most egregious example of that. There is no question in my mind, nor in the mind of the vast majority of the world's countries, that the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza, and also the Golan Heights, which is Syrian, are all occupied territory under international law. That's not something about which there's any disagreement. But by referring to these territories as disputed rather than as occupied, it's a way of neutralizing what's really going on and making it seem as though there are two sides that are much more even than they really are. It ignores the international law dimension and makes it seem as though this is just a disagreement like a couple who is having a disagreement about where they're going to go to dinner or something, rather than it being a profoundly important violation of international law.
Where are the settlers that are being pulled out of Gaza now going to go? And also, what kind of compensation, if any, are they being offered? I read that each Israeli family that obeys the government's orders to leave Gaza will receive as much as $300,000 under Sharon's plan. I read that in the San Jose Mercury News yesterday. What is being offered to them? What kind of compensation, and where will they go?
Well, here's one of the ironies, is that some of the settlers who are in Gaza are the same people who were first moved out of the Sinai when Israel signed the peace agreement with Egypt and then took the settlers out of the Sinai Peninsula. So those people are now being moved a second time and benefiting from this compensation. In terms of where they're going to go, there are a lot of different choices for them. There are some new towns that are being built very near to Gaza, and some people are planning on going there. Some are going to join other settlements in the West Bank. So some will go into pre-67 Israel. Some will go into the West Bank, which is occupied territory. Some will go into the expanded East Jerusalem settlements. There are a lot of different options. And, of course, there's a group of people who are saying that they will refuse to leave, although it seems quite clear to me that the military is prepared to use force to remove them, and so I don't think that there will be settlers in Gaza in another month. In terms of compensation, the compensation that they get depends on the size of the property that they own, how long they've been there, and so forth, but it is significant compensation. There's no question about that. And so they, in a sense, are benefiting twice. They benefited from being able to live on land at a very inexpensive price for many, many years, to get water at cheap rates, to have a very protected environment for their children and so forth. And now they're going to benefit economically a second time by leaving.
I want to read a quote to you that was in the San Jose Mercury News yesterday and get your reaction. It was a Palestinian attorney, Michael Tarazi, and he was talking about how he was referring to how some of the greenhouses that the Israeli settlers will be leaving behind are going to be purchased with international funds and transferred to Palestinians. He said, "We are pleased that we will be able to decide what to do with them." And then he went on to say, "It is somewhat obscene that settlers are being given compensation when Palestinian refugees have not been compensated for years." And I'm assuming he means both the compensation for the property as well as for the incentive to relocate without resisting. I'm wondering what you make of his comment.
Well, I think he's accurate, would be the short answer. I understand why, from a political standpoint, the Sharon government feels that it needs to give significant compensation to the Israeli settlers who are leaving, but it is abundantly clear that the Palestinians, including the 4+ million who are refugees outside of any part of mandatory Palestine, have never been compensated. Those Palestinians who have had their land confiscated within pre-67 Israel, many of them were not compensated. Some of them were offered compensation but refused it because they thought it would legitimize what they felt was an illegal stealing of their land. But in the case of the Palestinians who are losing territory right now because of the separation barrier, for instance, they're not receiving compensation. So, I mean, he's absolutely correct. He's also, I think, alluding to the fact that, although he doesn't say so in the part of the quote that you just read, that this process of so-called disengagement is going to take a tremendous toll on Palestinians in the short run as well as Israelis. It's going to involve huge limitations on Palestinian movement. It's going to jeopardize Palestinian access to things like health care and other essential services. And there are going to be closures. There are going to be curfews. And no one is talking about any kind of compensation or remuneration or any kind of way of rewarding the Palestinians or even acknowledging the inconvenience, huge inconvenience, that the disengagement, in quotes, is going to create for them as well.
We only have a few minutes left. I'm wondering if you could just conclude by kind of summarizing your thoughts and feelings on this and just answering the question, what do you think the most important thing or, you know, few things about this Gaza pullout that Americans should need to understand and what you think our role is?
That's a big question to try to do quickly.
I know.
But I think the most important things to keep in mind, to reiterate what we've already talked about, are first that this is a redeployment. It is not a permanent withdrawal. Israeli troops could go back in at any time. And so its significance is not nearly as great as it's being made out to be. That would be number one. Number two, that the attention being given to the Gaza, quote, withdrawal is distracting attention away from very serious violations of human rights which are occurring in the West Bank and specifically in East Jerusalem around the issues of the wall, the separation barrier, and also the expansion of settlements. And that third, and we haven't not really talked about this very much, that there's likely to be a certain amount of destabilization within the Palestinian community over this issue, as well as potentially some destabilization within the Israeli political system over this decision. In terms of what the United States should be doing, it seems quite clear to me that the United States needs to follow what it claims that it believes in, which is international law, and to cease being the one country who is constantly vetoing United Nations Security Council resolutions condemning the kinds of actions that we've been talking about.
And what can Americans do to ensure that our government changes their policy?
Well, there's the usual long list of things that you can try to do, which is individuals can support political candidates and representatives currently in office who have policies consistent with what I've just outlined. One of the things that is often said is that people are not very good at thanking their congressional representatives when they vote in ways consistent with what one thinks, that we're much more likely to criticize representatives than we are to thank them and to reward them. We have a political system where money, for instance, is one of the ways in which you reward people by giving contributions to their campaigns. But I also think the United States can serve a more active role. Individuals can serve a more active role by participating in groups like International Solidarity Movement or the Christian Peacemaker Team. They can educate themselves. They can educate others. They can go to the region and they can provide financial support to Palestinian communities that are being damaged by the human rights violations.
Thanks so much for your time today, Deborah. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Have a nice evening.
Good night.
Bye. That was Deborah Gerner. She is a professor of political science at the University of Kansas. She's co-director of the Center for International Political Analysis and a member of the editorial committee of Middle East Report. Gerner is editor of Understanding the Contemporary Middle East, 2004, and author of One Land, Two Peoples, The Conflict Over Palestine.
Thanks to Peace Talks on Free Radio Santa Cruz for that interview of Deborah Gerner. We now hear Palestine March by Pierce Woodward. Here's his description of this song. A multimedia response to the cycle of violence in the Middle East using samples collected at the April 20th, 2002 rally in Washington, D.C., voices from the alternative media, and an original mandolin tune.
And they're flying an Israeli flag. Very shocking sight. There are these great piles of rubble and debris in the middle of them, and there's a very unpleasant smell, pockets of what can only be described as stomach-churning smells, but from experience I know to be that of dead human beings.
Weekend, the stories of death and destruction continue to seep out of the Jenin refugee camp, which was once home to 15,000 Palestinians. Those who escaped describe how camp residents leapt from window to window and bulldozers, how some survived beneath the rubble and called for mobile phones, how some people were cut in half by tanks.
You have to understand what is at the root of those suicide bombings. It is hopelessness. It is lack of vision of a future. It is desperation to some extent, and it is also the long, long, long suffering of the Palestinian people that is only perpetuated by the ongoing occupation, the increasing occupation, and Israel's virtual ethnic cleansing policy that has been activated and accelerated by the Sharon government.
We all have within us a kind of a tribal instinct, you know, it's our tribe against everybody else. And it's the same, and the same is true in Israel. I mean, people are very attached to the Jewish, ideas, and the Israeli flag that only has the Star of David on it, not any symbol that brings in non-Jews.
Our government, the U.S. government, is funding the Israeli military, which is killing and humiliating Palestinians on a daily basis.
But what they're doing here is not unlike what we did for Afghanistan to get after a few quote-unquote terrorists.
So the idea is to be quite quiet in front of them and to make a first.
Wow! 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 Shut! The shutter! Fuck that! Hey man, fuck, he's shooting! He's shooting on the ground. They hit him! Can't see the guy. Did you see the cameraman right here in front of me? God damn it! They're shooting the people who are here with each other. And they're shooting, I can't believe this.
That was Pierce Woodward with Palestine March. You're listening to Making Waves. Now, we hear independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Attorney Leonard Weinglass, counsel for Antonio Guerrero of the Cuban Five, who talks about the recent landmark decision to overturn the espionage charges against five Cuban prisoners held in U.S. maximum security facilities. Journalist and author Frederick Clarkson, who examines the goals of the Christian Rights Justice Sunday campaign, promoting a radical transformation of the U.S. judiciary. And Celeste Zapala, mother of an American soldier killed in Iraq, and co-founder, along with Cindy Sheehan, of Gold Star Families for Peace, who describes what has drawn hundreds of people to vigil with Cindy in front of President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
According to the United Nations, one-third of the African nation of Niger's population of 11 million people, mostly subsistence farmers, are hungry. At the moment, 32,000 children are at risk of severe malnutrition and could die without emergency food and medical treatment. Critics say the Niger crisis could have been prevented. The Guardian newspaper notes, other semi-arid nations in Africa like Mali and Chad have suffered from drought and waves of locusts but have found a way to feed the hungry. The Famine Emergency Warning System Network, a Washington, D.C.-based group, charges that Niger exported its food surplus to richer West African nations, which drove up prices in local markets. Niger is the world's second poorest nation, where two-thirds of the population makes less than a dollar a day. The medical aid group, Doctors Without Borders, has blamed the current food crisis on Niger's pursuit of free trade policies. The government refused to hand out free food in the midst of this crisis out of fear it would disrupt the markets. The Pentagon is moving in federal court to block new video depictions of prisoner abuse at Iraq's infamous Abu Ghraib prison. According to the French AFP news agency, the video was shot by U.S. Army Sergeant Joseph Darby, whose earlier photos of Abu Ghraib triggered an international torture scandal last year. In court, the American Civil Liberties Union and other groups are seeking the public release of 87 photographs and 4 videotapes. Only 8 low-level U.S. soldiers have been convicted of abuses at Abu Ghraib, while all senior commanders were cleared of any wrongdoing. In a motion unsealed in court, Joint Chief of Staff Chairman Richard Myers stated the release of new images from Abu Ghraib would only help the Iraqi insurgents and should be blocked from public view. The Bush administration first objected to the release of the Abu Ghraib images as a violation of the Geneva Convention rights of the detainees. On June the 1st, a federal court rejected this argument and ordered the government to conceal individual identities on the tapes before their release. ACLU Executive Director Anthony Romero blamed the Pentagon brass for hiding behind a veil of rank and government office to avoid accountability. China's 25-year economic boom has transformed the village of Zidi 2, 100 miles east of Beijing. 100 factories now occupy the space of rice and cotton fields with 30 gasoline pumps as a sign of new affluence. Yet the industrial growth comes with a severe environmental cost. According to USA Today, dozens of chemical factories, including producers of sulfuric acid, dump wastewater in local rivers, which are the color of black ink. According to villagers, the cancer rate in the industrial area is 18 times the average. At this point, shutting down the chemical plants could cost $14 billion a year. Cotton farmer Liu Dequan was recently diagnosed with lung cancer and treatment could cost him nearly $15,000. He blamed the illness on the polluting factories, saying his family had no history of cancer. For the moment, the villagers' best hope against the polluting factories is to go to court. With the help of the Center for Legal Assistance to Pollution Victims, the residents want to try to close the factories, but the case will be tough to win. Local environmental agencies have so far refused to release data on the plants, and with so many chemical companies involved, it may be hard to pin down who is legally responsible for causing cancer and other diseases. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Intu Anand.
On August 9th, in a landmark decision, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, Georgia, overturned the convictions of the Cuban Five and awarded them a new trial with a change in venue. The three-judge panel based their decision on the premise that the five men could not get a fair trial in Miami, a hotbed of Castro opposition.
The five men, Gerardo Hernandez, Rene Gonzalez, Ruben Campa, Antonio Guerrero, and Luis Medina, are hailed as heroes in Cuba. Charged by the U.S. government with spying on U.S. military bases and exile leaders in Miami for Cuba, the five were arrested in Florida in 1998 and were tried and convicted of espionage, conspiracy, and other charges. However, the Cuban government claims the five were in Miami to monitor the actions of the right-wing Cuban exile community to protect Cuba from terrorist attacks. All five remain incarcerated for almost 3 years before their trial began in Miami in 2001, which was rife with prejudice, media bias, and even juror harassment. Two of the men were sentenced to 20 years, and three were given life sentences. Leonard Weinglass is one of the attorneys representing Antonio Guerrero of the Cuban Five. Your reporter Denise Manzari spoke with him about the significance of the appeal decision and what it means for U.S.-Cuba relations.
August 9th, I believe, the court handed down a 93-page opinion reversing the trial court, which refused to change venue of the case out of Miami, and setting aside all the convictions and ordering a new trial.
What is actually in those 93 pages?
Honestly, the longest venue decision ever given by an appellate court in the United States. It's a 93-page analysis of every aspect of the trial and the publicity and, most importantly, the social and political matrix of Miami. On all counts, the court found that the Miami venue couldn't give a fair trial, referring to all of those factors as a, quote, perfect storm, close quote, of bias, which was very satisfactory because it's precisely what we had argued to the trial court to take the case out of Miami.
They've been in jail for 7 years, and what appears to be almost coming out of a vacuum, this Court of Appeals overturns that and offers them a retrial. This was somewhat of a surprise to everybody, wasn't it?
Yes, you're absolutely right in saying that it comes out of a vacuum, although, frankly, it should not. This was, at the time the trial happened in the year 2000, the longest federal trial in the United States. It was a trial in which the 40-year history of the relationship between the United States and Cuba was examined in the courtroom. Admirals testified, generals testified, the advisor to the President of the United States, whose office is in the White House and was the advisor on Cuba, testified. So this case should have aroused a great deal of media attention, just given what it was. But the fact of the matter is, the case was hardly reported at all, and only this decision by the 11th Circuit this month got reported. So it does appear to be out of nowhere.
We know that Luis Posada Carriles, not to get too off track here, but all of this seems to be interconnected, was not granted his bond and is in currently, I believe, still in Texas. However, we do have other people like Orlando Bosch, who clearly seem to also be involved in terrorist activities in this country, who are free and living the life in Miami. And yet we have these five Cubans who are dispersed, we might add, through various areas in the country and whose wives and family are not allowed to visit them as well. With this decision, what happens to them now?
Well, what it means is, first, all their convictions are set aside, and they are returned to the status of presumably innocent people. And they go back to Miami, and they face a new trial. This means that the case will be moved out of Miami to where, I don't know. When the new trial will take place, we don't yet know. There's still a lot of work to be done. Will they get bail? We will apply for it. Are they bail eligible? Yes, they're eligible. Will it be given? We're not sure.
Can you talk a little bit about what happened at the first trial?
Human Rights Watch did a study of Miami, the only city in the United States which Human Rights Watch did a study of, and they found that this is a city with its own foreign policy, the only city in America where a statute of the city, actually a town council ordinance, required anyone doing business with the city to, in a sense, file an affidavit that they have never been to Cuba, and have nothing to do with the Cuban government. That was overturned. And it is the only city in America that will not allow a Cuban athlete to perform. That's why the Pan American Games had to be moved out of Miami. You can't have a Cuban film shown in a theater because the fire insurance would be canceled, or even a Cuban painting exhibited. So the appellate court looked at the questioning of 168 prospective jurors to find 12, found their answers to be reflective of a very strong and pervasive attitude against Cuba, and comments that happened during the trial, things that occurred after the trial, the jurors being harassed by cameras which chased them to their cars where their license plates were being filmed and shown on the evening news, the jurors being frightened, several of the jurors expressing their fear of what would happen if they voted the wrong way on this case. All of this added up to what the appellate court referred to as the perfect storm.
Since the decision was made on August 9th, is there anything, Mr. Weinglass, that you can talk about, that any changes or anything that's happening since then regarding this decision and what may be happening next?
The prosecutors have 21 days, I believe, in which to file for a review of this opinion by the full 11th Circuit. We haven't heard from them. We don't know if they're intending to do that or not, but we're just waiting to see what their next move will be.
That was Attorney Leonard Weinglass, counsel for the Cuban Five, who are now awaiting a new trial. For more information on the case, call the National Committee to Free the Five at area code 415-821-6545 or visit their website at www.freethefive.org. The conservative Christian fundamentalist movement across America has become an increasingly important constituency within the Republican Party. The Christian right's ability to mobilize voters is credited with the Republican Party's winning streak in recent national and state elections. Political observers say that on issues such as abortion, gay marriage, and stem cell research, Christian conservatives virtually dictate GOP policy positions. The case of Terri Schiavo in Florida saw President Bush and Republican congressional leaders attempt to prevent Terri's husband from terminating life support for the woman who had been in a persistent vegetative state for 15 years. Public opinion swung strongly against the GOP's unsuccessful attempt to intervene in the Schiavo family dispute. The Christian right is currently engaged in a fight to transform the nation's judicial system and push for the appointment of conservative judges to the federal bench. Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council, is the organizer of two gatherings of conservative clergy and Republican politicians dubbed Justice Sunday, the most recent event being held in Nashville on August 14th. James Dobson, founder of Focus on the Family, speaking at the gathering broadcast nationally on TV and radio, branded the judiciary as unelected, unaccountable, and arrogant. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Frederick Clarkson, who has written about the religious right for over two decades. He discusses the goals of the Christian fundamentalist Justice Sunday campaign and their push to change the balance on the Supreme Court.
They were broadcasting this event from church in Nashville. It was sent out by satellite and into people's homes and into churches that people gathered to watch around the country. They said some extraordinary things at the event, which was led by none other than House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. And he called the federal judiciary and the American judicial system is described as judicial supremacy, a judicial aristocracy. He said rights are invented out of whole cloth. Long-standing traditions are found to be unconstitutional. Moral values that have defined the progress of human civilization for millennia are cast aside in favor of those espoused by a handful of unelected lifetime-appointed judges. The demagoguing of the American judiciary is just an astounding thing. The Christian right leaders went even farther. But that was the House Majority Leader. There's an effort underway to strip the federal courts of their power to protect our individual rights, whether it's in their whole areas of civil rights or reproductive rights. Their interpretation of what the federal judiciary should be would have made it impossible for the courts to advance, say, the African-American civil rights movement. And certainly would have made it impossible for reproductive rights to go forward.
Fred Clarkson, tell us a bit about the primary organizer of this event, Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council.
Tony Perkins is a longtime Christian right activist. Family Research Council was originally the Washington lobbying arm of James Dobson's Focus on the Family, and it later became independent, although James Dobson is still on the board of directors. And Tony Perkins came up through James Dobson's political farm team. There's a network of some 35 state-level think tanks and political advocacy groups that are generally referred to as family policy councils. And Tony Perkins was head of the Louisiana group. And just prior to his being involved with that, he'd been a campaign manager for a conservative Republican Senate candidate named Woody Jenkins. In the course of managing that campaign, he cut secret deals with the former head of the Ku Klux Klan in the area called David Duke, who had run for office and had a considerable mailing list. And Tony Perkins cut a deal with David Duke to buy his mailing list and to conceal it from state and federal authorities. So that's the kind of guy Tony Perkins is, who's now running the Family Research Council. And he's been a very effective, boyish good looks kind of demagogue for the Christian right as a leader. And he's really been the point man in claiming that anybody who opposes President Bush's judicial nominations are opposed to people of faith or opposed to Christianity itself.
Fred, what's your view of Judge John Roberts and his nomination to the Supreme Court? This particular gathering, Justice Sunday 2, was on the theme of changing the judiciary, and there was some mention of him, although he wasn't as prominent as it was expected. How does Judge John Roberts fit into the Christian right agenda?
Well, it's a little bit hard to tell in that he hasn't been a federal judge for very long, but and the Bush administration has been very parsimonious with the internal papers that he wrote while working as an assistant White House counsel and as an assistant solicitor general during the Reagan and Bush administrations previously. And what I've seen from press reports on his papers, he disagrees that the right to privacy, as discussed in the Griswold contraception case, is to be found in the Constitution. He doesn't think that the Supreme Court's ruling on banning overt prayers in the schools has any basis. He didn't see it as the business of the courts to get into that. He certainly disagrees with Roe v. Wade because he doesn't see a fundamental right to privacy. Everything is coming out about his judicial philosophy in terms of comments he's made to colleagues who've known him over the years, and the stuff we've seen in his writings suggests that his philosophy is very much in tune with that of James Dobson. And the only question will be, assuming he's confirmed, would be to what extent he's willing to roll back precedent. There's some indication that he's something of a pragmatist and a conservative in the sense that you don't radically overturn previous Supreme Court decisions lightly. But it doesn't change the fact that he thinks that a whole series of really important civil rights decisions were wrongly decided in the first place, and that is every indication to think that his inclination would be to find a way to overturn them.
That was author and journalist Frederick Clarkson. His book, Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, is published by Common Courage Press. Visit his website at www.frederickclarkson.com. What began as a lonely vigil in front of President Bush's Crawford, Texas ranch by Cindy Sheehan, the mother of a U.S. soldier killed in Iraq, has transformed into a powerful expression of the growing anti-war sentiment among Americans. Hundreds of peace activists, veterans, and families of servicemen and women killed, wounded, or currently serving in Iraq have converged on Crawford to support Sheehan's call for a face-to-face meeting with the president to ask the question, what noble cause have our soldiers died for in Iraq? Supporters of the president have organized counter-protests in Crawford. One 46-year-old man used his pickup truck to run over hundreds of white crosses, each painted with the name of a fallen U.S. soldier. The unscripted, spontaneous movement that Sheehan sparked comes as public opinion polls find increasing opposition to the war. A poll conducted by CNN Gallup USA Today found that Americans by a 55-44% majority believe that the U.S. made a mistake in sending troops to Iraq. 56% of those polled say some or all U.S. troops should be withdrawn now. Celeste Zapala of Philadelphia traveled to Crawford to stand outside the president's ranch with Cindy Sheehan and hundreds of other supporters. Her oldest son, Pennsylvania National Guardsman Sergeant Sherwood Baker, was killed in Baghdad in April 2004. She is a co-founder, along with Cindy Sheehan, of Gold Star Families for Peace. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Zapala about the power of the Crawford protest and why she advocates a quick withdrawal of troops from Iraq.
I feel that Cindy's stand is important. It's really important. And it's important that the world and the president recognize that it's Cindy's raising the voice. And there are many of us who have that voice, too. Those of us who have lost kids, who have decided that the war was not a noble cause and not something that you could justify, need to have a place that we can speak about that. And as other families who have members who are serving and are great fear about what's happening to them and think that the war is wrong, sometimes it takes somebody to open the door, and then there are many people who will come through. And I wanted to help be one of the voices that's there to speak and to give Cindy support and try to add another perspective. I understand that this is quite a phenomena, and I understand that people will continue to try to just make it a he said, she said, Cindy did this, Cindy did that, and that's what puts a lot of pressure on her, and it's a struggle, it's hard, but we can't lose sight of the fact that the war's going on, that every day more people are dying, either Americans or Iraqis. And we have to find a way out of this. We got to find a way to bring our troops home. We got to find a way to craft a different kind of foreign policy that doesn't treat our soldiers and other populations as expendable resources. And I want to protect other people from losing their kids and going through this experience that we've gone through. Even if they don't agree with me, I want their kids to be whole and safe.
Celeste, how do you explain the power of what's happening in Crawford, Texas, given that there are certainly some critics, but I would think by and large, there's a lot of respect for what Cindy Sheehan and the hundreds of others are doing to demand some answers from our president at his ranch in Crawford, Texas.
I've been thinking about this, and I think it's because it's made up of real people whom others can look at and say, yeah, if that was my son, I'd want to know too. You know, when you see the talking heads on CNN or Fox and you listen to the celebrity folks and people sort of say, oh, well, you know, that's what they do for a living. But this is real different. This is the real people. We're the people who have actually buried our kids. We're the people who wait for phone calls every night to make sure that their kids are not the next ones down. And they're just ordinary, common people. And maybe that's what stirs people, that they can identify, that they can be awed by Cindy's courage to go and do this outrageous thing, but maybe they can really identify too that, you know, she's been on this journey since her son died. She's been seeking honest answers, and now she's got the courage to go to the most powerful place in the world and say why. And she's just a regular person. She was not a celebrity. She was not a politician. She's just a mom from California. And that's true for all of us. We're not celebrities. We're not special. We just happen to have children who were extraordinary human beings, and they're gone.
Celeste, as you look to the future, what are your plans to advocate for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, as I know you are advocating?
Yeah, well, I'm I'll try to be as vocal. I'll talk to everybody I can. I'm also I'm a church person, so I'm involved with the religious community, and I am trying to focus a lot of my attention on the religious community to try to help people find their voices there. We're also planning for the demonstrations in Washington on the third week of September, September 24th. There'll be people from all over who will come to Washington and seek answers. We might be doing a bus trip that will take military families and Gold Star families and Iraq vets to various small towns in the country to engage in dialogue. You know, part of what I think is exciting and a little bit of a miracle is that I think we have started a national conversation that really needs to happen about what we're doing in Iraq. And maybe people will be reluctant to turn away and pretend that they don't know what's going on or that they don't have to care about what's going on. They do need to care. Even if they're not directly affected, even if their children are not directly there, this is their fellow citizens. This is being done in their name. They're paying $1 billion a week for it. And so if we can bring that home to people that, you know, it could have been you, but it happens to be me in this situation. But at some point in the future, it can be your kin. And what are you going to do about it? How are you going to make sure that you don't allow this war to continue to the slaughter and utter catastrophe of the world with no purpose, with no plan, with nothing that makes any sense at all? You know, and I guess that's what I ask people. What are you going to do about it? When Sherwood was little and something would happen that was not little, but he was a young man, and he would hear something, some political outrage or something would go wrong in the world, and he'd call me on the phone and he'd say, "Mom, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about this, Mom?" And I hear his voice all the time. What are you going to do about it? And I'm doing everything I can. Everything I can.
That was Celeste Zappala, a co-founder of Gold Star Families for Peace, who had recently camped out with Cindy Sheehan near President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. For more information on the Crawford Vigil, visit the Gold Star Families website at www.gsfp.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Myrowitz, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation, too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday, August 27th, from 2 to 4, for our next Making Waves program with the theme of Confronting the War Makers. We'll be hearing interviews with Mary Lee Sargent from New Hampshire Peace Action on the campaign and civil disobedience action at Judd Gregg's Concord office, and New Hampshire author Tom Lee about his recent book entitled Battle Babble, Selling War in America. We leave you with this quote by Agatha Christie. One is left with a horrible feeling now that war settles nothing, that to win a war is as disastrous as to lose one.